Thank you, Jim, and good morning, everybody. My name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here this morning. Thank all of you for putting this conference together and for asking me to be here. I know that so many people have worked hard. Anytime you have a conference as beautiful as this one is, and the face of it to me is kind of Ben Harlan, who's running around here somewhere and won't hear me thanking him, but I know there are a lot of folks behind Harlan, too, so thank all of you so much. And my wife came with me. We made a little vacation out of it because our wedding anniversary is December the 26th, and my belly button birthday was yesterday, 39 years old again. So we've just had a great few days here in the Northwest, and thank you. But, you know, as beautiful as the country is out here, I think the spirit of what I've seen in Alcoholics Anonymous on my few trips out here is even more beautiful. In many ways, Alcoholics Anonymous is the same everywhere, but then in other ways, Alcoholics Anonymous has a different personality in different areas of the country. And you guys have just got a wonderful group AA personality, and the spirit is just beautiful, and thank you for letting me be a little part of it this weekend. And what we're supposed to do this morning is I'm supposed to run my mouth a little while about the maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12, and I'm real grateful to be able to do that because they are really, really important to me. But first, let me tell you what I'm not. I am not a teacher. There are no teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the folks over the years that I've seen who it looked like they might aspire to being teachers, I have never wanted anything that they have. All that I have to share with you is truly my experience, strength, and hope. And with God's help, all I'll share this morning is my experience with 10, 11, and 12 and what I have told folks that I sponsor and other folks in Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've observed about 10, 11, and 12. There's an old friend of mine that I haven't seen for years by the name of Creighton P. Called him the captain. I know Polly remembers him, Dave, and but Creighton was in poor health the last I heard of him. But for several years there, Creighton and I seemed like we were winding up at the same place four or five times a year. And he would sometimes open his talk with something that I really like. He would tell people, said, "Let me tell you a little something about us conference or circuit speakers. We are not more sober than you are. We are not better members of Alcoholics Anonymous than you are. We are not more spiritual than you are. And we don't know more about the recovery program than you do. However, by and large, we are more enchanted with the sound of our own voices." Now, I'm sure that's not true of every one of us, but we truly, all of us, and I know most of our other speakers this weekend, and I know that they would agree with me. We are just other drunks just like you. The question of what am I doing up here is one answered really simply. Somebody asked me. I have never once gotten in touch with the AA central office in some area and said, I think you folks are lagging a little bit in your spiritual program. Think you need a revival. Maybe I need to come out and give you a little kick in the butt on that. I've never done that. I'm here only because that I'm asked. And I don't know anything special about it, but I'm real grateful to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope on 10, 11, and 12. And for you new folks who may be here this morning, 10, 11, and 12 are what we call the maintenance steps. They're the ones that we live on after we've done steps 1 through 9 and reached a state of recovery. And I believe that after we've done 1 through 9, the way this book says do it, we have reached a state of recovery. Dave made a point last night that the book says that we are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of body and mind. My original sponsor in Nashville, Tennessee, and by the way, I've been sober a day at a time by the grace of God since April the 9th of 1981. And I'm not going to tell you folks much of my story during this afternoon, and if you're glutton enough for punishment, you can come back tonight and get the story. But my original sponsor in Nashville, Tennessee, always made a point to me that I could call myself a recovering alcoholic if I wanted to. But just to be aware that that was a treatment center innovation and that the book talked about recovered alcoholics. Well, by that time, I'd become quite a big book scholar, so I said, where did they have that in the big book? And he said, first place they hid it was in the subtitle. I didn't even know the book had a subtitle. Said, then they hid it twice more in the first paragraph to the foreword to the first edition. He also said something else to me, and I made no connection between those things, nor did I understand them until I'd been sober quite a while. He said, as far as I'm concerned, you only do steps 1 through 9 one time. He said, now, the catch in that is that every single thing that is involved in steps 1 through 9 is included in 10, 11, and 12. And as I say, I didn't understand what he meant by either one of those things, but a few years later, I figured it out. You know, a friend of mine says that the definition of an epiphany or a great awakening is when I figure out for myself what people have been telling me for years. But I know what it was. He didn't want me to view myself as a poor, sick, little, crippled alcoholic involved in a never-ending process of just trying to get mired out of the mud and going on and never getting okay, just trying my best to fight it and get a little better, because he knew who he was dealing with. He knew that if he allowed me to grab hold of that, that there's a good shot that 20 or 25 years later, if I managed to stay dry, that I'd be sitting around a clubhouse somewhere playing cards and whining about, I can't get out there in that world with them earth people. They don't understand me. I might get drunk. You know, I can't get out there and work those jobs where those people don't understand my spirituality. He wanted me to understand that once I've done these first 9 steps the way the book tells me to do them, and I'm living on 10, 11, and 12 every day of my life, I ought to be at least as capable of dealing with this world eye to eye on its terms as a person who never had alcoholism. He wanted me to understand that I'm not a lifetime cripple. So he didn't make a big deal out of that, and I don't make a big deal out of that. With the people I sponsor, I tell them, you can call yourself recovering alcoholic if you want to. You can call yourself redoing the steps 1,000 times if you want to, just as long as you do it. You see, in my sobriety, I've done, a dozen or more inventories that look just exactly like a 4-step inventory. I take them straight out of the book, pages 64 through 70. But in my mind, those are not new 4 steps. That's 10th step work of continuing to take personal inventory. As I'll talk about in a few minutes when I talk about step 11, part of my morning meditation for years has been that I read the 3rd step prayer, and I read the 7th step prayer. But in my mind, I'm not redoing my 3rd step, and I'm not redoing my 7th step. I'm doing 11th step work. I'm seeking to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. And as I say, I'm not on a soapbox about that. My sponsor wasn't. I don't get on a soapbox with my sponsees, but I thought I would share it with you. Also, going back to something that Dave also mentioned last night, and I'm so looking forward to Carol this afternoon, and I'm sorry that I have to leave early in the morning. Gonna miss Polly and Don, but you folks are gonna be blessed. But he talked about the difference between the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Program of Recovery. You know, the first 164 pages of the Big Book are the entire text of our Program of Recovery. And the only thing that is referred to as a program for recovery in that first 164 pages are the 12 steps. Here are the steps we took that are suggested as a program of recovery. And what was explained to me and what it has been my experience is absolutely true is that I can be a member of this fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking. And thank God there are no further requirements other than that, because there was a while in which I could do no more than that. But if I latch hold of this fellowship like a parasite, the fellowship being meetings, you can even have somebody who calls you, you can call a sponsor if they'll let you do that without doing the steps. You may be able to find somebody who hasn't done the steps who agrees to let you call them a sponsor. But if I latch on to this fellowship, I may stay dry a week, and I may stay dry 30 years. But if I do that, I'll have no healing of what's really wrong with me, of that disordered ego. You know, the book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And the way that was explained to me, that means the first thing wrong with me is I've got a disorder of my ego. And on account of it, without divine intervention, I'm so obsessed with myself. I'm so obsessed with how I feel. I'm so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people that a couple of things happen necessarily. Number one, without divine intervention, I'll wind up always letting how I feel be the most important thing in this world. Without divine intervention, it'll trump everything. There is no love, there's no situation, there's no ambition big enough to stand up against that ego, that self-centeredness, demanding that I let how I feel be the most important thing in this world to me. The other thing that necessarily happens with all that obsession on self is that I wind up with so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me that I can't stand the way I feel without either running as hard as I can and or stuffing something in there to try to make me feel good enough that I can stand it. So the bottom line for me is, I can be a member of the fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking. But unless I'm somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9 the way this book says do them, or having done that, I'm living every day on 10, 11, and 12 in order to get my daily reprieve and not fall back in the pit and die of this incurable, progressive, and fatal thing, I'm not even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just in the fellowship. Another thing that my sponsor would correct me on was when I would say, my program, he'd say, wait a minute, partner. He'd say, your program got you here. Your program destroyed everything in your life. Dave was talking about that last night, a complete derelict, and I made it there too. I'm not going to try to tell my story from up here, but believe me, I lived a year and a half without an address. I lost absolutely everything material that a person can lose. But, gosh, I lost my train of thought. Isn't that amazing? but at any rate, the program of recovery is what he would tell me, that my program had done that to me. My program had destroyed everything. That this is not about my program and your program. It's about the program, and it's numbered 1 through 12. You know, we may approach it a little differently, but the program is the same, and it's numbered 1 through 12. He also said some really deep philosophical things, like if you weren't supposed to do the steps in order, they wouldn't have numbered them. You know, things that just, wow, where did he come up with that? now, for the new folks, though, I have found, I was sponsored to believe, and I found in my experience, that really you can start using 10, 11, and 12. As soon as you come in the doors, you don't have to wait to complete 9 in order to use 10, 11, and 12. I believe working them in order is absolutely critical with 1 through 9, because we are not ready for 2 until we've accepted the conclusions that are involved in 1. We're not ready for 3 until we've accepted the conclusions that are involved in 2. We certainly aren't ready for 4 until we have done the action that constitutes the decision involved in 3, and so on and so forth. Give you an example of why I believe, or a little story about why I believe that. You know, I've had a world of people tell me, man, I can't do this resentment list. I can't make amends to those people. My God, they're 5 steps from even considering making amends to them. They might get run over by a truck, get drunk, whatever. You know, that's unreality. And when our minds jump ahead, this is what happens. One of my favorite stories is about an alcoholic that had a flat tire out on an old dark country road, and he didn't have a spare, or didn't have a jack. So he looked up, and way down the road, sees a little pinpoint of light. Starts walking toward it, and the committee meets in his head and starts talking, you know. Said, well, maybe it's not even a house. Maybe it's just outlight. Gets close enough and see his house. Well, maybe it's a house, but nobody's home. Maybe they're home, but they won't answer the door. Maybe they answer the door, and they hadn't got a jack. Maybe they answer the door, and they got a jack, but they won't let me borrow it. Maybe they answer the door, they got a jack, and I borrow it and walk all the way back here, and it's the wrong jack. Won't fit. About this time, he's knocked on the door, and an old farmer comes to the door and says, can I help you? Alcoholic said, I didn't want to borrow your damn jack anyway. But at any rate, having done those first 9 steps, we're told that our ego will be deflated. In my experience, that lasts approximately 3.5 seconds, because the human ego is absolutely the most resilient thing on the face of this earth. Especially, I believe, in alcoholics, our egos can survive any lick and come out intact. I believe when we die in a gutter, more likely than not, we're not there thinking about how pitiful we are. We're thinking about how much smarter we are than the Square Johns and how misunderstood we've been and that sort of thing. The ego comes right back. Just like, as my first sponsor told me, all character defects are recurring. They always recur. I tend to be the way I was. Without divine intervention, I tend to be the way I was. So these maintenance steps are so critical. Kind of haven't had a lead in there. Let me tell you what I'm so glad I misread for years. You know, I have trouble reading the big book. And the reason I have trouble reading the big book is I know what it says. If you already know what that book says, it's hard to get a whole bunch out of it. You know, if you're already positive that you know what it says. And it takes divine intervention for me to get that little moment of clarity and be able to look at actually what the ink on the paper says. And for the first 2 or 3 years I was sober, I want to tell you it was scary, because I knew what that book said when it talked about the 10th step. It said that my daily reprieve was contingent on my spiritual condition. And that was awful. Because I know some of you folks that have got these years of sobriety have reached the point where you are just eternally serene and never have anything disturb you, and certainly never wake up with your mind spinning or afraid of anything or feeling the edges of that hole coming back in the belly. I want to tell you, I hadn't got there yet. There are mornings when I wake up and the way I feel feels like to me my spiritual condition's crap. Okay. Now, for those years where I thought that book said that my daily reprieve was contingent on my spiritual condition, contingent on how I am, that was terrifying. Because on those days, I was a little dry leaf out here on the wind. And if it blew the wrong way, I might be struck drunk. Because I believed that my daily reprieve was contingent on how I was. When I finally got that moment of clarity to see what the ink on the paper says, it doesn't say that at all. Says that my daily reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. If you drove a car here today that's sitting out there somewhere, that car has a condition. And there's nothing you can do to wave a wand and immediately change the condition of that car. On the other hand, there is a process of maintaining that car. And that is all action over which we have 100% control. So when I was able to see what the book really says, it was one of those things that's like flipping a light switch. It's not a gradual realization. It's wow. My daily reprieve went from completely beyond my immediate control to completely within my immediate control. You see, my daily reprieve here on December 30th, 2006, doesn't have anything to do with what kind of spiritual condition I'm in. It has to do with what actions I take to maintain my spiritual condition that day. You see, what that means is that if I wake up feeling all funky, feeling like I'm cut off from you and cut off from God, don't want to pray, know it won't do any good if I do pray, got way too many big deals going on to think about taking the time to pray, but if I make myself get down on my knees and do the best I can to say those words, when it comes, and then with my meditation books, if I know I can't remember a word, if I try to read it, but I open the book and I try to go through there and do the best I can. When it comes time to make my gratitude list, if I don't feel grateful for a thing, you know, I can sit there and look at it 10 minutes and maybe come up with my eyes, you know. But I can sit there and make a list of what a fellow would be grateful for in my situation if he had an ounce of sanity. And then I'd go on to my office, and I'll talk a little bit later about big deals, because I've got a disease of big deals. Without divine intervention, anything that I can make have anything to do with me, I blow up into a great big deal. Now, if it's going on with you, I'd be St. Francis. Oh, don't worry about that. You just let God worry about the pattern. You do the stitching. I can see God will take it to a wonderful place. You let it happen to me. And, oh, my God, it's the end of the world, you know, because it's me. You see, anytime I make a big deal out of anything, anything, including my health, my children, my sex life, my money, anytime I make a big deal out of anything that is not God and not these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego and I'm back into alcoholism and I'm crippled. The big deals absolutely cripple me. You know, if I make a big deal out of my role in my sponsee's life, if I make it such a big deal that I'm the one that gets them or keeps them sober, or I'm the one that lets them get drunk, it'll break my back. I can't sponsor many folks. You know, I need to realize that all I can do is carry a message. I've got sponsees this very weekend out talking at conferences, people throwing gardenias at them, telling them what spiritual giants they are, and that's fine. I've got other guys this weekend that are in graveyards and in penitentiaries. And as far as I know, I told them all the same thing, and much more importantly, I showed them all the same thing. And I'm so blessed because I don't feel any pride. I'm happy for the guys that are doing well, but I don't feel any pride. And I don't feel any guilt about the guys that are in the graveyards and the penitentiaries. Consequently, I can give my attention to the next person that comes up and says, Don, will you help me? Whereas if I'm all turned in on myself with the big deal of how important I am, there's not enough of me left. But at any rate, on this morning I'm talking about, I'd be down at the office and involved in one of my big deals. And one of the things that I always tell everybody who asks me to sponsor them is that for me to give advice on either relationships or finances ought to be a felony. But they insist on doing it from time to time anyway. And I don't think I'm sponsoring anybody named Joe right now, so we'll use Joe. Old Joe's calling, and it's the 10th time he's called in 2 days to talk about the girl. And I've got my big deal going on. I can't tell Joe anything about the girl, you know. And it's so important that I take care of what I take care of right now. And every fiber of my being wants to tell the receptionist, for God's sake, take a number and tell Joe. I'll get to him when I can. But I can pray those magic prayers, those 11th step prayers. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Joe rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. And I can tell the receptionist, yes, put him through. And I can pick up that phone and I can say, good morning, Joe. How are you? What can I do for you, buddy? And if I keep running those prayers through my head, miracles will happen. The first miracle that will happen is that they'll make me something that by nature I am not. They will make me a listener. And then maybe Chuck C's wonderful words will come into me and I'll realize that anything that I give my entire interest, attention, and love to will for that moment become the most interesting thing in the world. And if I run those prayers through, and the third miracle, the miracle of praying to love, comfort, and understand, it is a spiritual law I have found out for me that as long as I am seeking to be loved, comforted, and understood, I cannot, will not, ever be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. As long as I'm looking for it, I cannot have it. You give me exactly what I thought I wanted from you, but if I'm looking for it and demanding it, I'll change what I want. I'll change what I want. There won't even be a blink of true satisfaction from that. The only time I'm ever loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I'm praying and truly trying to lay aside whether I'm loved, comforted, or understood at all, and truly trying to love, comfort, and understand you, then that miracle happens, and I'm loved, comforted, and understood beyond my wildest dreams. Just wonderful. Noon can roll around on this day I'm talking about. There's a noon meeting at a clubhouse right across the river from my office. I know everybody that goes there. The acoustics are terrible, and I'm deaf. I can't hear one word out of five that's said. Doesn't matter. I've heard it all anyway. I'm still in my big deal. Couldn't possibly do any good to go to that fool meeting. But I can make myself get up and go across the river to that meeting, and I can go with the right question in mind. You see, the wrong question for me is, what am I getting out of this? Let me tell you why that's the wrong question. I don't care what I ask it about. I don't care whether it's my children, whether it's my wife, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous, my work. You let me ask the question, what am I getting out of this, and study about it for about 30 seconds, and the answer is always not enough. So it's just simply the wrong question. Same paradox as with the love, comfort, and understand. As long as I'm asking the question, what am I getting out of this, it is a spiritual law, I won't get enough to satisfy me. It is only when I ask the question, what can I bring to this, that I will get enough to satisfy me. It's the only way I can be filled up. And I can go over to that fool meeting asking that question. I can get through that day, and I'm absolutely guaranteed that I won't take a drink of alcohol that day by this book, because I've done the action on that day to get my daily reprieve. Now, the flip side of that coin is I wake up feeling so spiritually exalted that God and I are going to join hands and go out and drift through the ether somewhere. And it can occur to me, well, why should I get on my knees and pray? My whole life is a prayer. And when Joe calls, I can be involved in advanced spirituality, and I can feel so warmly toward Joe, but I just don't have time because I'm advancing to an exalted level of spirituality and not have time to talk to him. And I can get drunk and coot a brown on that day, despite the fact I feel like I'm just spiritually centered as I can be. So that's great news. There we go. Well, I have taken longer in the preamble to the steps than I meant to, but let me talk about step 10. I've got a dear friend, and Terry was asking me about Billy this weekend, Billy H. from Louisville, and Billy says that the most important word in all the 12 steps is in step 10, is continued. Continued. And you know that is so true. Because when I paint myself in the corner with my paintbrush of self-will, and I'm capable of doing that 50 times a day even now, the solution of getting out of that corner is never to obtain some new esoteric spiritual truth. It's go back and do the same fool things I did when I was 30 and 60 days sober. It's pray. It's set out with a pencil and piece of paper. It's talk to my sponsors. Go to more meetings. I don't ever need to learn anything else. I've had more than enough knowledge about recovery for decades to stay sober a day at a time and live a good life the rest of my life. What I need to do is continue. I need to be willing to go back and do those same things that work. See, I've got a lot of devils inside me. And one of my big devils is, and I know this sounds crazy and we say it like a joke, but it's truth. If something works too well, I'll quit. You know, if it just works real, real well, I'll just quit it. I don't know whether something inside me is saying, well, this working so well, no need doing it now, and pick it up again any time. But I tell you, I can't always pick it up. First few years I was sober, I got into exercising when I'd wake up in the morning. For the first 5 years, I had a certain number of sit-ups, push-ups, and leg lifts that I did every morning. Didn't miss a morning, even if I'd had surgery. Sometime in 1986, I missed a morning, hadn't done one since. You know, haven't done a single one. But at any rate, I need to continue. Continue to take personal inventory. That includes a number of things for me. It includes, as I said, in my case, I've done a number of full written inventories that look just exactly like a fourth step, but I choose to call them 10th step work. It includes a little paragraph that's on page 86 that's actually included in step 11, but I use it as part of my inventory. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And it's got a wonderful little checklist. Where were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? The questions get progressively harder, by the way. What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? And that last one, folks, that's in every step. That's everywhere. This deal is not about what we can do for ourselves. This deal is really ultimately not even about keeping ourselves spiritual and sober. The way we stay spiritual and sober is trying to help other people. Third step, take away my difficulties. Not so I can be sober, not so I can be happy, not so I can be spiritual, but take away my difficulties so that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. Here, after we make the review we just talked about, We ask God's forgiveness. But it says before that, it says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Not because that's uncomfortable and unspiritual. You see, and I understand why folks sometimes say that AA is a selfish program, and I really do try to stay away from controversy. I love the statement in this book that we would like nothing so well as to write a volume that would stir no controversy. I see no value in controversy in my recovery at all. And I've been very, very blessed in that regard. As I'll tell you all tonight, what I've done all my adult life for a living is I'm a criminal defense lawyer, except for the years when the state of Kentucky requested that I refrain from said activity. And I can honestly say, and this is not a brag, this is just true gratitude. In the last more than 20 years, if you have caught me arguing with somebody, somebody's been paying me. I will not argue with you for nothing. I simply will not make my belly hurt. I will not do it. It's no longer, and that's the gift from God to me. It is no longer that important to me whether you are right or I'm right. I can see you doing something that I wouldn't do a tradition that way. And I'm so blessed, I've never once had an emotional reaction to that. I'll think, man, I wouldn't do that. But it doesn't hit me. I've got to do something. I've got to save Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got to do something about that guy. Because tell you what, it occurred to me that as long as I live, there's always going to be enough like-minded people that I can find to sit down and have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's only one human being who can destroy AA for Don Major. And guess who that is? That's me. And one way I can do it is by becoming a policeman and a judge. Real simple. If God had wanted me to be a policeman, I would know, because I would have a badge and a gun. If God had wanted me to be a judge, I'd know that too, because I'd have a robe and a gavel. So consequently, I choose to leave the policing and the judging to those people who are in a better position to do that. But at any rate, I don't want to be controversial, because I do understand the point that people are making when they say AA is a selfish program, because certainly if we don't stay sober, we're no good to ourselves or anybody else. But what I've got is a selfish illness, and I cannot effectively treat it by more obsession on self. It doesn't make any difference if I dress that up in psychological clothing. It doesn't make any difference if I dress that up in spiritual clothing. If I'm trying to treat an illness that is, in fact, self-centeredness, by more obsession on self, I'm trying to put out a fire with gasoline. It's not going to work. Where my relief comes is doing something for you, being open to your problems. I don't need to try to take care of me. And I took this straight out of Chuck Chamberlain. I've lived it and it works. It's not my job to take care of me. That's God's job. It's my job to try to help you folks do what you need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. And when I'll do that, God never ever fails in God's job. But when I jump back into trying to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver and take care of me and get mine and keep mine, I'm right back in the snake pit. I'll go to that snake pit every time. But when I'll back off and say, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, I've screwed up again, I'm going to leave the pattern up to you. You use that little spark of the divine that's in all of us to tell me where to take the next stitch, because that's all I'm capable of. Then it begins to work out great. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. It was explained to me that the word promptly is there only for my comfort. If I want to be comfortable eventually, I can eventually admit it. But if I want to be comfortable promptly, I better promptly better promptly admit it. Step 11. I just absolutely love step 11. And tonight I'll probably talk about step 6 and 7 and something that happened when I was 9 years sober. And 6 and 7 have kind of been at the center of my sobriety since 1990. But up until then, it was step 11. And step 11 is still so important to me. I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees, to my knowledge, since sometime in April of 81. Not telling you that to tell you how good I am. I started completely acting as if. Tonight, I'll tell you what a problem I had getting here. Just exactly like Dave mentioned last night, the higher power thing made me madder than the God thing, because I knew what you were talking about. You were trying to backdoor me with that God crap, and that insulted my intellectual integrity even more for you to do that than the God thing did. It made the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. But due to some miracles that I'll talk about tonight, I started getting down there on my knees in April of 81, and I haven't missed a morning or night. Now, a good half those thousands of mornings and nights, I hadn't really wanted to. A whole bunch of times, I could have gotten medical statements that I didn't feel like getting down there. A bunch of times, I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers and judges that I didn't have time to get down there. And a whole bunch of times, it's been clear that it couldn't possibly be doing any good. I was so distracted that it seemed, couldn't remember the last word. I just tried to pray, and the words were bouncing off the walls and ceiling. But I've gotten down there every morning, every night, and something's worked every single day. Something has worked every single day. And that's the second most important thing in my sobriety. The most important thing is simple. And that is today, just for today, with God's help and yours, I'm not going to drink or take dope if my butt falls off. Because you see, I believe, again, like Chuck C., not God's job to keep me sober. My job not to drink alcohol and take dope. Now, I get a world of help from God, and I get a world of help from you guys. But there's no way in the world I can ever abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. Powerless over alcohol does not mean powerless over my elbow. But anyway, I don't know how to sponsor folks. My method of sponsoring is different than some. And again, on the controversy, I applaud the structured sponsorship and have dear friends who are icons of structured sponsorship. And occasionally we'll send at home I try not to use the term Nazi AA, but I will say that I sponsor the local Reichsfuhrer. And I respect that. And I send people there if my way doesn't work, but I don't ever tell people what they have to do. I don't ever tell them you have to do this. I do tell them things like, please don't ask me for any hints on how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night, because I don't have a clue. I was absolutely unable to do it. And it's the only thing I know to show you. And it's the only thing that I know works. Now, I've been 100% as far as I know on that. As far as my morning meditation, I've been pretty darn good on that. I expect I've done it 80% of the mornings the last 25 years. My morning meditation consists of reading the daily meditation from a couple of books and reading the third step prayer, seventh step prayer, and pages 86 through the top of page 88, the 11th step. And then my meditation, which I thought would be the most impractical thing in the world, is simply sitting there with a pencil and a piece of paper, making a list of 10 things that I'm either grateful for or would be if I had any sanity, and then make a list of a few things that are capable of complete accomplishing that day, that if I do them, I will be more comfortable, and if I don't do them, I will be less comfortable. Because, you see, I learned a wonderful, complicated truth from my first sponsor. I do all the praying I want to. I do all the inventories I want to. I talk to all the sponsors I want to. But the only way I will ever become comfortable is by doing things that make me comfortable and stopping doing things that make me uncomfortable. There's simply no way around that. Now, for 25 years sober, I've been trying to figure out a way to be comfortable driving 85 and 65 mile an hour zone. There just seems like there ought to be a way that a fellow could get there. And I keep trying, you know. And when I get back to my car, I'll be trying again. But I want to tell you, there ain't no way to get comfortable. I know that. That's just my insanity. The only way I'll ever get comfortable is by doing things that make me comfortable and stopping doing things that make me uncomfortable. So it wound up that meditation is the most practical thing in my day. So many things I had turned around 180 degrees just backwards. Where I fall down on the 11th step is the other 98% of the time. I do real well on the 1% in the morning, the 1% at night. I'll go and I'll drift away from my living this book, which says that every day, all day, regardless of whatever's going on, I constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show, humbly saying to myself many times, "Thy will be done." And that's in quotation marks. it's real clear that the book's telling us that we say that specifically. And when I do that, and by the way, the prayer of St. Francis, from which praying to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comfort, and understand comes from, is on page 99 of the 12 and 12, which is where the 12 and 12 talks about the 11th step. So I consider that part of my 11th step prayer. When I take the 11th step through the other 98% of my day, it works a whole much better. It works a whole much better. That 2%'s great, and I got to have that 2%. But where I miss out is when I don't take it all the way through my day. When I'm doing it right, I do little silly things like inviting God into the car with me. Sometimes open the door for God and let God go in before me. I know it sounds stupid, but it helps me remain conscious. It helps me remain in conscious contact with my God. And it just helps me a whole bunch. And I need to always run that through my head. And I've always said those prayers are the miracle prayers for me. They are absolute miracle prayers. By the way, one quick thing, and I'll move on to step 12 for a while. When I began to become spiritually erudite in my early sobriety, I thought I was going to astound the wise men in the temple, I think, after having been an agnostic and nearly died from it, you know. A couple of months after that, I'm trying to impress my original sponsor, and I said, well, now, just when and how do I begin in the day to start this process of trying to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him? And Cherry referred me, his name was Cherry Carpenter, by the way, in Nashville, Tennessee. Cherry referred me to page 86. He said, Don, it says here that on awakening, we think about 24 hours ahead, we consider our plans for the day, and before we begin that even, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. He said, Don, if they had meant for you to do that after you went to the bathroom, it would have said, after we peed, we ask God to direct our thinking. He said, now there are several reasons why you need to do it on awakening immediately. He said, number one, because that's what books says do. And said, if you got any chance to live, and said, you were a real scholar on this book while you were dying, as far as knowledge of the book. So if you got any chance of living, you're going to have to come to this book like a little child and act like you've never laid eyes on it before and look at what the ink on the paper says and follow it literally. So the big reason you need to do that is because that's what the book says do. Said the other reason is you are perfectly capable of getting crazy enough between the bed and the pot to ruin the rest of your life. So over the years, I have pretty well conditioned myself. By far the majority of the times, about the first thing that runs through my head when my eyes fly open are, God, please direct my thinking, especially let it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I had all these notes that I use when I do a day-long step thing up here, and I don't think I've looked at them. By the way, interestingly, you know, if we take step 11 literally, the only prayer we ever pray is for knowledge of God's will for us, the power to carry that out. Chuck Chamberlain, I understand, had pretty well reached the point that was his prayer. God, give me knowledge of your will and the power to carry it out. I'm not there. I still pray for God to get me through the day without drinking or drugging or wanting to, and I pray for a lot of other things, but I try to be very careful, just like the book says, to never pray for my own selfish ends. I try not to confuse faith and hope. And it's so easy for me to do that. You see, I want to have faith that my health will be all right. I want to have faith that my kids will be okay. I want to have faith that my sex life and my money will be okay. Ain't going to happen, guys. Those things are not subject to faith. That's hope. That's my will. I'm not even dealing with faith until I'm trying to get to a point where whatever happens with my health, whatever happens with the kids, whatever happens with the sex life, whatever happens with the money, that I'm going to be okay. That's when I'm dealing with faith. And another thing, I used to think that faith was a feeling, that nice, warm, fuzzy feeling that God's got me in the palm of his or her hands and everything's okay. No way. No, that's the reward for faith. Faith is a really uncomfortable action. I sometimes say it's a verb, it's not a noun. What faith is taking that next stitch where in my heart, that little spark of the divine tells me it needs to be taken, when it looks like to me that the pattern that we're forming is not going to work right. When it looks like to me that I won't get something I really want, or I'll lose something I really don't want to lose. That's what faith is. is going ahead and taking that stitch and accepting by my actions that I can't comprehend the patterns of my life. When I'm trying to figure out the patterns in my life, and this will really shock y'all, but I was joking about turning 39 yesterday. I turned 63 yesterday, and I've never seen a single pattern in my life successfully. Not one single one have I ever seen right. Why I want to waste my time sitting back and saying, let me figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching, I don't know. Because my job's stitching. And when I'll go back and I'll do that, where my God has taken me is more beautiful than I can ever imagine. step 12. Gosh, I love step 12. And, you know, going on a 12-step call, when I was 5 or 6 days sober, I went with, you know, people that had plenty of sobriety, but I believe that was a real key in my staying sober. Was them picking me up at that clubhouse there. The old boy's name was Harold. And Harold was sitting there telling us what a high IQ he had, and he couldn't find his mouth with his cigarette. He was telling us how intelligent he was, and he was in the same mess that I'd been in a week before. So we don't want in early sobriety to go off on our own and go out trying to grab people off bar stools. We never, ever in early sobriety need to do 12-step work without our sponsors or other solid members of AA with us to do it. But I think it's real good to be involved with it. I think it's real good to know from the very first that the only thing that separates this from all those things that Dave was talking about last night that we have tried to use on alcoholism that didn't work, there's not much that separates it. But one of the huge things that separates us is that it's built on one alcoholic helping another. You know, the book says that nothing, absolutely nothing, will so ensure our sobriety as working with another alcoholic. Let me tell you what that means. You know, this is one of those deals about the ink on the paper. That means that as far as my not drinking alcohol, working with other alcoholics is more important than prayer. That means that as far as not drinking alcohol, working with other alcoholics is more important than meetings. That means that as far as not drinking alcohol, working with other alcoholics is more important than having a sponsor. Now, I know that all sounds like heresy, and all those things that I just mentioned are absolutely necessary. But be aware that the book says that none of those things will so much ensure us staying away from alcohol as working with another alcoholic. And there's no other way you can interpret what the ink on that paper says other than that that is the bottom line. That will ensure it when nothing else will. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Now, I've heard a lot of discussion, and actually there's an appendix on the book on spiritual experience and so on, about the definition of a spiritual awakening. I want to tell you that it has never puzzled me at all. I've always taken it quite literally. What it means is that I have become spiritually awake. Because you see, I was spiritually comatose all my life. I was asleep, unconscious to the spiritual world around me. Doing the first 9 steps and working on up to 12 didn't necessarily make me spiritual, but it did wake me up. It did make me awake to the spiritual world that's around me, aware of it. And, of course, we've all heard it 1,000 times, but interestingly, the article adjective there is the, not a, that the only thing within the four corners of the steps that we really promised within the four corners of the steps that we're going to get is that we're promised that, that we will have a spiritual awakening. And I want to jump back. I lost track of my time, by the way. I thought I was 15 minutes later than I was. So I left out a few things on step 10 I want to talk about. Step 10 has just got so much great stuff in it. That's where the AA code is, by the way. It says, our code is love and tolerance of others. Now, if they had meant that the code was efficiency and responsibility, I expect they'd have put it there. Now, efficiency and responsibility are wonderful things, and they've got a distinct spiritual aspect. There's no question about it. But the code is love and tolerance of others, and I need to live that. And I've been blessed in that regard. It's very easy for me. If I can't tell whether tough love or kindness is in order, if I've got any reasonable doubt at all, I'm going to err on the side of kindness. I simply am. I'm not saying I don't ever abuse tough love. I do. There are times when it seems absolutely clear that for the welfare of the person I'm dealing with, or because it's not doing any good and for my own welfare and for the welfare of preserving my time and energy for somebody for whom it might be some good, there are times when I do exercise tough love. But if there's any doubt, I go with kindness. And with me, it's real simple. I would much rather have on my tombstone, "Don was kind," than to have on there, "Don didn't take any crap." I'd just a whole lot rather have my tombstone say that. I want to talk a minute about tolerance, too. I was confused about what tolerance was. I thought if what you did was mildly irritating, but I could kind of shrug my shoulders and say, "Well, don't guess he's hurting anything," and go on, that was tolerance. That's not tolerance. That's a high threshold for aggravation. Tolerance is not even an issue until I find what you're doing intolerable. It's not an issue until every fiber of my being screams that, by God, somebody's got to stop you, and it must be me. That it's just God's will for me to tell you what's wrong with you. By the way, I have looked and looked in the first 164 pages of where it tells me when I go to people and tell them what's wrong with them and just how I do that. It's not in there. There's not one word in that book about me telling folks what's wrong with them. Now, I will tell you that once about every 6 months, it seems so clear that it's God's will, and if I don't tell them, how will they know that it clearly becomes an exception, and I have to go tell them? It hadn't worked a single time. I always come away feeling like an empty shell, and, you know, I'm not aware of one single thing that any of those folks have changed when I told them what was wrong with them. So tolerance isn't an issue until I find what you're doing intolerable. By the same token, you know, all I really have to forgive is the unforgivable. If you cut me off in traffic, or if you cheat me out of $5, if I don't want to forgive you, if I want to hang on to that resentment, I'd probably do it. You know, just be uncomfortable, but I probably won't get drunk. But if you sexually molest my child, or if you cripple me, or if you wrong me in any other terrible way, I better forgive you. All that I must forgive if I'm going to live is the unforgivable. Just like the only things that I must tolerate are the things that I find intolerable. Tenth step also says this is where we can exercise our will all we want to, as long as we try to conform it to God's will. It also says something that I believe is perhaps the most quoted out of context thing in the big book. It says, as God's children, we don't have to crawl before anybody. How many times have we heard that said in this tone of voice? By God, I'm one of God's kids, and I don't have to crawl before that SOB. Well, that's all fine and good, but you need to read the sentence right before that. It says, we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. And then and only then, as God's people, can I stand on my feet and not crawl before anyone. So I need to be aware that little preamble to my not having to crawl before anyone is there, long as I have been sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble. Okay, back to step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carried this message to other alcoholics. Thank God that word is carry. Thank God that word is not deliver. If that word was deliver, that would be an impossible order. None of us can do that. Right back to what I said earlier about, you know, sponsees at conferences, sponsees in graveyards. All I can do is carry it. The delivery is up to God and the person that either gets it or doesn't get it. I can't go beyond that. And you know, we carry a message with us constantly. I was telling some folks as we were standing outside before a little incident that happened in my sobriety. When I got back to Louisville sober in 1983, I was asked to speak at a local meeting there in the summer of 83 that was held at a middle school. And when we got there, they were doing some remodeling work on the middle school, and we couldn't go in, so the meeting had to be outside. They set it up under a shade tree at the end of the school property. And while they were reading how it works, the guy that lives next door got out his lawnmower and his beer bottle and started mowing the yard. So I'm up there screaming over this lawnmower, absolutely convinced that God's will is just being thwarted, that nothing good can come out of this at all. About 2 years later, I'm at a clubhouse there in Louisville, and a guy comes up to me and said, "You remember giving that talk at Highland Middle School a couple of years ago, and the fellow got out and was mowing the yard and drinking beer?" I said, "Yeah, I remember that." He said, "I'm that guy." I said, "I heard enough that the next week I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober since then." You see, I never know what's going on. I don't need to be giving somebody the finger in traffic. You see, somebody might see that I never know about, and that might be the picture of Don Major's recovery, and for that person, that might be their main picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's their picture of my higher power and how well that looks. What I need to do, I need to ask myself, before I do or say anything, if this were on the front page of the local paper tomorrow, would it be a disaster? We all do private things we don't want in the paper tomorrow. But would it be truly a disaster? Am I getting ready to say something about somebody that if that was on the paper tomorrow, it would just be awful? You know, would there be really bad consequences from that? And if the answer is that yes, it would be a disaster, I better not say it or do it. Because I don't know what's going on. One more story I want to tell, just that I never know what's going on. Was the last time I was with Dr. Paul, Dave. I was with Dr. Paul over in Virginia. I guess it was 10 or 12 years ago. And I think the Friday night speaker. And I was giving, we were up on a dais like this. And there were 300, 400, 500 people there. And I'm giving my talk. And when you give a talk, you tend to make eye contact with certain people in the audience. And man, it was this guy on the front row. He had on a baseball jersey and a cap. And I was making eye contact with him. And he was nodding at all the right places, laughing at all the right places, interrupting with the applause at all the right places. I'm thinking, I got this guy. I got him. Well, after the meeting's over, we get down, and I come down off the podium, and the way we lined up to say the Lord's Prayer, I was directly in front of him, about 3 feet from him, facing him. So we finished the Lord's Prayer, so I think I'll just get the jump on him on his humble, heartfelt congratulations on my wonderful talk. So I take a step forward and stick out my hand, and that guy looked straight at my hand and turned on his heel and walked off. Well, I stood up there with 200 or 300 people coming up and hugging me and telling me his great talk and that sort of thing. That's one thing you learn as a circuit speaker. People will rarely come up and say, "That's the crappiest AA talk I ever heard." So, you know, you need to kind of take it with a grain of salt. But I didn't enjoy a bit of it. All I could think about was what I had done to offend this guy. I mean, I'm just absolutely miserable because... not a very spiritual giant, but a quote from Marlon Brando that really describes me. He said that if I'm in a room with 200 people and one person doesn't like me, I have to leave. And I'm the same way. You know, I can't stand it. So I'm just egotistical. So I'm just miserable. And Sharon, my wife, was with me. And afterwards, we were walking back to the room. I'm telling her, "My God, I don't know what I did." And I looked across the yard, and there the fellow was with his hand on another man's shoulder being led away. He was glad. And that man led him over, and that man hugged me and told me how much he enjoyed the talk. You see, my perception of reality is something that I don't need to rely on a whole lot. And I need to be aware that I'm carrying a message everywhere I go. There's a message with me, and the people that I have helped the most and hurt the most in my life, I may not even know. I may not even be aware that that's happened. And that's true of every one of us. That's true of every one of us, regardless of what our lives are like. Sponsorship, and that belongs in the 12th step. I think sponsorship is absolutely critical. I do not believe I could have stayed sober without sponsorship. I asked Cherry to be my sponsor when I was 5 days sober. And I will tell you that I knew him quite well, and he knew me quite well, and I did not like Cherry when I asked him to sponsor me. And he did not like me. Cherry remained my sponsor for approximately 8.5 years until his death. And Cherry never did get where he liked me very well, and I never got where I was hog wild about Cherry. He's the second most important man in my life next to my father. And Cherry Carpenter and I never shared a meal. We never rode in an automobile together, not one inch. And he never called me on the telephone except to return my telephone call. He was not my friend. He was my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he never failed to respond when I had a question about these steps. And he made sure that I had the information. He gave me his hand. And he walked me through these steps that are the only program for recovery we've got. He taught me some things that are very valuable. And he did it in a way that I could hear it. He didn't do it in a mean way because, sorry, I'm just this way. Somebody people did try that with me, and hell with it, I'd leave. I wasn't going to respond to that. But Cherry got his point across. We got points across like that there was way too much discussion about talking with one sponsor. That there ought to be a whole lot more discussion about listening to one sponsor. Cherry didn't believe that anybody had ever talked themselves well. If you think you can talk yourself well, go to a psychiatrist or psychoanalyst. Don't come to AA. He made it clear that what I needed to do was call him, state the problem, shut up, listen to the solution, and not bother him unless or until I had taken the action that had been suggested. And that worked with me. When I got back to Louisville when I was 21 months sober, I very soon got a Louisville sponsor, Bernie, that I kept. Now, Bernie and I became great friends. Bernie and I were dear friends. He was a sponsor for 16 years up until he died. And if I went to Bernie with a financial problem, poor Bernie would all do things like offer to loan me money, you know, try to help me solve the money problem. I have often wondered what would have happened if I'd asked Cherry Carpenter to borrow $5. It would have been hideous. It would have been a nightmare. Now, the point I'm trying to get across is get yourself a sponsor. Your sponsor may or may not wind up being your best friend. And being your best friend is not nearly as important as being a guide through these steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody that will tell you the truth. Cherry always said that he would rather be despised for who he was than loved for who he was not. I don't know that I'm strong enough to be that strong as Cherry was, but there's a whole lot of truth in that. And that's what he gave me. I'll also tell you this. A lot of what you've heard today, a lot of what everybody hears anytime I talk, comes from to me through Cherry Carpenter. I couldn't have had a more knowledgeable, better sponsor. Yet I believe with all my heart, having had such a knowledgeable, Cherry was a circuit speaker, sponsored 100 people. Having had such a sponsor is 1% of the value of Cherry's sponsorship to me. 99% of it was my willingness to choose a sponsor and to do what that sponsor said. Because, listen, if you choose somebody with some sobriety that's done the first 9 steps and living on 10, 11, and 12, they're not going to tell you anything wrong. And if you're like me, and most new folks, I think we are like that, whatever they tell you is going to be a whole lot better than what we're going to figure out on our own. Just going to be a whole lot better. And there's so much value in simply doing what we are told rather than trying to figure it out for ourselves. I want to talk a little bit about practicing these principles in all of our affairs, and then I'll sit down and shut up. And I'm just going to do it by shotgunning you with some things. My fear of prayer, by the way, has evolved over the years. It used to be, God, please remove my fear. God, please remove my fear so I can do the thing that I'm afraid of doing that needs to be done. Fear never got removed one single time. Finally, somebody suggested that if I was hungry and locked myself in a closet and prayed for a hot dog, it wasn't likely one would come squirting through the keyhole. So my prayer changed from that to, God, please give me the strength to act in spite of my fear. And I found out that when I would say that prayer on my knees and then get up and start walking toward that which I feared when I was still afraid, that's when God removes it. God doesn't remove it as long as I'm laying on the sofa or on my knees, you know, calling up my sponsor and aggravating him. But I'm afraid to let the IRS know what I've done here. I'm afraid to file that tax return, you know, or whatever it is. It isn't until I take the action, begin to take the action, that God will remove the fear. I'm too busy not to go to meetings. The reason for that, of course, is the natural thing is I'm too busy to go. There's something magical about what AA meetings do to time and energy for me. They somehow magically expand it. I'm too busy not to go to meetings. My decision process is not nearly as important as I thought it was. I used to think that God had set up the universe like a game show, and if I guessed the right square, I got trips to Acapulco. And if I guessed the wrong square, I got dragons. That'd be a peculiar way for a loving God to set up a universe. The fact is that when I have a good faith decision, and for instance, the decision of whether to rob a bank or go to a meeting is probably not a good faith decision. But if I really don't know which way to go, and I've talked to the right people, and I've gotten in a room by myself, said a prayer, drawn a line down the middle of a piece of paper like Cherry taught me, written on one side why I should go this way, another side that, and I really can't tell. Bottom line, simple. Whichever fork in the road I take, if I do God's will a step at a time, do my stitching right, it'll be great. Whichever fork of the road I take, if I don't do that, it'll turn to a bucket of crap. Therefore, what's the big deal about my little decision-making process? It's just another way of blowing me out of proportion. It's another way of blowing my mind and me and making a big deal out of me. The only way I've ever found to simplify my life, by the way, is not to make all those great long lists that I made about simplification, not to get outside counseling about simplification, which I've done. Turns out the only thing that will simplify my mind, my life, is making a series of simpler choices. You see, without divine intervention, I'll blow through the day with no thought of which is simpler. And I've found out that 80% of my telephone calls, with no negativity whatsoever, I have the choice of whether to leave the ball in the other person's court or keep it in mine. No negativity whatsoever. Seems to make no difference to the other person. Another thing, if the answer is going to be no, tell people no. People will call me up and ask if I want to go do something. I know I don't want to do it. I know I'm not going to do it. But I'll say, oh, let me talk to Sharon or check my calendar on that. You know, by the time, 3 or 4 days later, I can't think about anything else. I'm miserable, wondering, you know, when that guy's going to call, what I'm going to tell him. You know, simplify my life. Do the simpler things. The answer's going to be no. Give him a quiet and loving no. Let it go and be there. I need to live my life like a little 1920s Western Union messenger boy, peddling around in one of those funny little uniforms delivering messages. You know, if that fella took responsibility for the contents of those messages and for the reaction of the recipients, nobody on earth could do that job. It'd be way too hard. It'd absolutely break their back. That little fellow's job is to peddle around and quietly and lovingly deliver the message. My job is always the quiet and loving delivery of the truth. I have never once created the truth at any given time. God knows I've tried, but I never once create the truth. And my job is that quiet and loving delivery. I believe with all my heart there is no honesty without compassion. I believe honesty without compassion is really veiled hostility. So I think the quiet and loving part is very important. I found out in my personal life and in my law practice, by the way, I've always been a criminal trial lawyer. I found out it's never necessary to raise my voice. I found out that courtesy is the most spiritual, most effective thing on earth. Courtesy is very, very spiritual. Just simply being courteous. It doesn't make any difference how difficult what I have to tell you is going to be for you. I can tell you in a manner that is courteous. And I need to be courteous to those closest to me. That's one of our insane tendencies, is we'll be courteous to strangers, and the people that we love the most that are closest to us, we'll just treat them awful. You know, if we treated a stranger that way, we'd be appalled. I need to treat my cat with courtesy. I need to treat Sharon with courtesy. I need to treat vending machines with courtesy. I just need to be courteous. And that's such a spirit. I need to return my telephone calls. If you don't think returning telephone calls is spiritual, if your life is anything like mine, I get 40, 50 phone calls a day, go 48 hours and not return them, you'll be living in hell. You will absolutely be living in hell. And all telephone calls are telephone calls. So he's attending, look at it, it's not really a telephone call. Old Don doesn't care whether I call him back or not. All telephone calls are telephone calls. Because I just think I know what people want. I could give you some real stories about me being convinced of who it was and what they wanted and making the telephone call and finding out it wasn't anything like that at all. Something entirely different. By the way, May of 1990, I was up in Cleveland with a new sponsor, Tom Burns. And there was a fellow up there that had been sober 20 years, and there was a lot not to admire about Jim. He's dead now. He had been sober 20 years, and he had lived the last 7 or 8 years underground in Las Vegas making his living playing poker. Because he'd owned some big truck dealerships and he'd gotten into some extramarital affairs and a lot of other things and wound up owing the government $2 or $3 million in withholding tax. So he literally had to live underground. So it was a lot not to admire about Jim, but he gave me something that weekend that's been so valuable. I asked him, I said, Jim, how does it work making a living playing poker? He said, Don, worldwide, there probably millions of people who would love to make a living playing poker, and there are only 700 or 800 of us worldwide that can do it. And he said it has absolutely nothing to do with how we play the good hands. He said the entire difference between success and failure is what we do with the bad hands. And I found out that that's true in every part of my life. I want to concentrate all the goodies and knock the ball out of the park. It's the ones that I don't even want to look at. What I wind up doing with those will wind up making the difference between success and failure in every part of my life, if I'll remember that the bad hands are what I need to take care of. Anything is better done than perfect. I view my success in my mind, bases loaded, that's the only sports metaphor I'll use, bases loaded, bottom of the ninth, my team's behind by 3 runs, 2 men out, I hit a home run on a frozen road out of the ballpark. What my success winds up being is I've about half got the flu, don't think I feel like playing, my uniform's got a hole in it, it's probably going to rain, I dress anyway, I go to the ballpark, I finally get in as a pinch hitter, I break my bat and bloop a little single over the second baseman's head. All of my successes have come from all those broken bat singles. It doesn't ever work the way I've got it in my mind of hitting that ball out of the park. By the way, balancing my life. I spent almost 2 years sober, obsessed with balancing my life. It was like between 2 and 4 years sober. God, I did inventories. I got outside counseling. I was finally in a discussion meeting at the clubhouse where my home group meets, and there was a fellow I never saw before or since, but I remember that he had been out of the asylum 2 days. And I was talking about balancing my life, and he said, Don, if you could balance your life, why couldn't you manage it? Of course I can't balance my life, but God can balance it. When I'll take that next stitch in the right place and do it, it'll work just fine. If my problem is that my bed is not made, I can do anything I want to. Pray, do inventories, talk to my sponsor, get outside help, and I won't get any relief until I make that fool bed. None at all. Folks, thank you so much for putting up with me this morning, and I love you, and I hope that I can live enough of 10, 11, and 12 today to get my daily reprieve. Thank you.